I can get you a tow. Believe me. There are ways, dude. You don't want to know about it, believe me.
Yeah, but Walter...
Hell, I can get you a tow by 3 o'clock this afternoon with nail polish.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens! What kind of radio show is this?
Based on what the witnesses tell you, what's the general reaction from their higher-ups when something like this goes down? Just to sort of hush them up? Is it commonplace to the point where, you know, to the big dog, you know, they come into town to the Air Force base and they're like, you know, this happens all the time, so just shut your mouth kind of thing? Or is it more like, you know, they're spooked too?
It really varies. And I was discussing this very question with Bob Salas, the former missile launch officer at Malmstrom, within the past week. We were discussing the various ways that these kinds of incidents have been handled over the years. And, you know, it almost seems that there's no rhyme or reason to it. What I have, for example, to give you some examples, a man named Walter Billings, who was a lieutenant, a missile launch officer at F.E. Warren Air Force Base in the early 1970s, describes an incident one evening in the fall of 1973 where, while he was on duty in alert down in one of these underground launch capsules, he and his commander heard on the radio, linking all of the other launch control capsules, that suddenly a what's called security alert team, group of missile police, air policemen were responding to an alarm at one of these missile silos. There had been some sort of intrusion. What Mr. Billings and persons connected to all of these 20 launch control facilities heard was that as this team of Air Force police approached the missile silo, they observed a UFO right next to the missile silo. In fact, I believe he said hovering directly over the missile silo. Now, when this was investigated, Billings said that as soon as all the crews got back to base, they were basically told not to discuss the incident. But the only team, the only two missile officers that were interrogated, according to Billings, interrogated by OSI, were the team of the launch control facility that was in charge of the particular launch facility, the missile in question. Mm-hmm. So you have sort of a dual response. You have persons who are directly involved, presumably the missile security alert team, in addition to the launch officers for that group of missiles, being debriefed by OSI. In fact, Billings said those guys wouldn't talk to anyone afterwards. On the other hand, the other people who were indirectly aware of the incidents were basically just told as a group, don't discuss this, but there was no individual debriefing. I have found similar responses or similar descriptions at other bases at other time frames from the 60s into the 90s.
And have there ever been anything that you would like sort of classify as a close call type of situation? It sounds more like the UFOs shut down the nukes, but have there ever been any sort of situation where, you know, they turned them on?
I am not personally aware of any incident in the United States of this type where the launch sequence was activated, but indeed there apparently is at least one instance of that very development within the former Soviet Union, I believe in October of 82, off the top of my head here, at a launch facility in the Ukraine. Reporter George Knapp, who has done a lot of investigating regarding Soviet UFO incidents, published documents, interviewed persons who were involved in this incident, whereby apparently a UFO hovered over this missile base for several hours at a high altitude where Soviet fighters could not reach it, and at some point down in one of these launch control facilities, the launch officers were horrified to see that the missile launch sequence for this one missile had activated itself with no human intervention. And apparently for 15 seconds, this automated launch sequence was proceeding apace, while the people frantically were attempting to shut it down to no avail. After this 15-second period, the electronic functioning of the system returned to normal. As I recall, Knapp said that the Soviet officer involved said that all of the equipment was disassembled, and no evidence of any kind of anomaly could be found in it. So apparently you have, at least in this instance, not a question, not an instance of interruption of functionality of the missile, but actual activation of it. If such a thing has occurred in the U.S., I have not heard about it.
Yeah, yeah. That actually touches on the next question I was going to ask you, and that's about this international aspect of the UFO phenomenon and nuclear and the nuclear thing. Outside of the USSR and the one you just talked about, have you discovered much elsewhere with regards to this sort of thing?
I do not really research sightings elsewhere in the world. I mean, I have a very full plate with just what's going on in the U.S. here, but I take a more than a passing interest in it, of course. I've heard stories that I could not substantiate regarding incidents occurring, sightings occurring in Pakistan and India in the late 90s at a time when there were nuclear weapons tests by both countries, underground detonations. There were reportedly a number of UFO sightings in that region following or around the time of those particular series of tests. But I have not been able, I have not really pursued in terms of trying to locate and interview witnesses who might have knowledge of that. Getting back to U.S. forces in England, the famous Bentwaters case that most of your listeners have probably heard about in December of 1980, I have interviewed the deputy base commander, Charles Hall, about a year ago, and he substantiated, in fact, went into greater detail regarding what he had already said publicly for 20 years now, that in fact, while they were sighting UFOs out in the woods near the airbase and quite clearly dealing with objects that were vastly beyond conventional aircraft in terms of their capabilities, Halt has confirmed to me and to other researchers and journalists that at least one of the objects was reported hovering directly over the weapons storage area where unspecified types of nuclear weapons were stored, either missile warheads, tactical missile warheads, which would be used in a battlefield setting, or other types of nuclear weapons. And the fascinating thing about this particular UFO incursion at the weapons storage area is that a number of guards and Halt himself saw the UFO shooting what seemed to be a laser-like beam directly down onto one of the laser or weapons bunkers, rather. And so that type of thing obviously is quite dramatic, even though it occurred in England, it involved U.S. nuclear weapons. Jumping back again to the Soviet Union, there is another case on record that your listeners can find online. There was a Soviet missile test facility called Kapustin Yar, K-A-P-U-S-T-I-N-Y-A-R, which had a number of facilities involved with nuclear missile testing and so on. And in July of 1989, according to declassified KGB documents, Soviet intelligence agency documents, there was actually an instance of a UFO hovering over that facility's nuclear weapons storage facility and shooting a beam of light down into it, virtually a carbon copy of what Colonel Halt has described as having occurred at the Bentwaters base. So very intriguing kinds of things going on both sides of the ocean. Certainly, you know, the kinds of events that my sources are describing in the U.S. have been occurring in the Soviet Union and now Russia.
Yeah, yeah. And to sort of like take a big picture look at all this, and I'm sure it's obviously speculative because we don't know what's going on in the minds of the pilots of the UFOs, whatever they may be. But what do you think is the message here with this UFO nuke connection? They're not happy with what we're doing with the nukes?
When I speak publicly, in particular in my lectures, I try to limit my personal opinions and just let the facts speak for themselves, mm-hmm. the documents and the testimony of these retired military people. And I insert a minimum of my own perspective on the subject. But obviously, one could not have studied this subject for 30 years and not have an opinion about what's going on.
Yeah.
So my opinion is that the technology that's involved with the UFO phenomenon is so in advance of anything that we humans have from the 40s to the present day. I think clearly we're dealing with a technology that has not been demonstrated to exist on Earth. Therefore, we're dealing with beings from somewhere else. Whether they be extraterrestrial or interdimensional, I don't presume to know. But I think clearly you've got an intelligence involved with the phenomenon. And it seems apparent to me that one of the items on their agenda in terms of their interaction at this point in human history is quite clearly connected to nuclear weapons and our possession of them, our testing them, our threatened use of them in war and so on. I think that clearly is involved with what's going on in terms of what they're doing, their activities at this point in time.
Yeah.
I tend to agree with the majority of my sources that someone is demonstrating that they have the ability to interfere with our use of nuclear weapons. Whether or not these small-scale incidents could be duplicated on a worldwide scale, if you know, worse came to worse, and we and some other country, either China or Russia, do at some point in our future decide to go to war and use nuclear weapons, whether or not the same kinds of disruptions that have been reported at various Air Force bases and so on could be affected worldwide so that every nuclear missile launch could be interfered with, I don't presume to know. And I suspect that the Pentagon and CIA and the Kremlin and the successor to the KGB probably don't have a clue either.
Yeah, kind of probably almost as an additional layer of mutually assured destruction in a sense, where now they're probably wondering if they'd even be able to use them at this point.
Well, yeah, it's an open.
Let's hope they don't.
It's an open question. You know, there's speculation is a game that anyone can play, and you know, you asked me my two cents, so I gave them to you. But I think clearly, what beyond mere speculation, just in terms of documenting what's taken place, you've got an ongoing pattern of surveillance by UFOs at nuclear weapons sites. You have also a more limited number of instances of apparent disruption, in my mind, premeditated disruption of those systems. That's about all one can say with any legitimacy at this point, I think.
Yeah. And now this one also is kind of speculative, but maybe you might have heard more from your witnesses and that kind of thing. And that is, have there been any sort of attempts by the government to thwart this UFO interference on the nuclear bases? Obviously, there's a lot of talk about, you know, like the Star Wars, the SDI thing maybe being used against UFOs and not for nuclear weapons after all, and that sort of thing, or maybe even engaging pilots to, you know, chase off the UFOs. Is there any history of that sort of thing where, you know, instead of just being like, oh, no, there's a UFO over the thing, they're like, get it?
There are countless, I would say hundreds if not thousands, of instances of UFOs being chased by military jet aircraft around the world. I can attest both from declassified documents and from the statements provided to me by FAA controllers at Malmstrom Air Force Base that, in fact, jets were launched to investigate UFO incursions of sensitive airspace, in other words, at these nuclear missile silos. So I know these after-the-fact responses were undertaken. As far as proactively attempting to protect weapons like through Star Wars technology or something like that, I've heard those rumors for 20 years.
Yeah.
I'm sure everyone else has. But I'm unaware of any real substantiation to the fact that that's going on.
All right. That kind of wraps up the nuke portion of the discussion, and I want to move in now to like a general ufology talk here. And the first thing I wanted to ask you about luckily we keep referencing things we find online, but I'll try and maybe put a link up to this too. And that was someone transcribed a presentation of yours, and you mentioned that you had personally investigated what I guess could be dubbed as the Benowitz saga at Kirtland Air Force Base, and I think you're kind of situated in that area anyway. So I'm sure being a part of ufology in that area during that time must have been just a heady experience. So let's talk about your investigation into what was going on with the Benowitz story.
Oh that's a very long story. I can simply say that I am one of the few people who met with him face-to-face at his Thunder Scientific Laboratories, I believe off the top of my head here, in the spring of 1985. I was with him close to 2 hours, and in my lay opinion, not being a psychiatrist, my lay opinion is that the man was sadly psychotic. He was clearly mentally unbalanced, and I feel a little uncomfortable, to be honest with you, going into some of the things that he told me and showed me, because they were, in my mind, demonstrations of his psychosis.
Yeah.
And he's dead, as I think most people know. His family is still in Albuquerque. They still operate the labs, and I just think it might be indelicate of me to describe it at length what I witnessed, so I'm not going to go there. In the same context, though, the so-called MJ-12 papers, documents that have been circulating now for 20 years, I did investigate them and the persons involved with, in my view, producing them. I think they are fraudulent. I think they are probably disinformation. Clearly, a retired OSI agent named Richard Doty was up to his neck in disseminating this information, as was ufologist Bill Moore. Whether Moore was duped by Doty or was knowledgeably participating in a disinformation scheme, I think is open to question. Moore has discussed at length his involvement and how he, in effect, was recruited by Doty to disseminate information, but he, based on what I've read, he more or less tries to present himself as somebody who was playing along with Doty to ferret out the good secrets. In my view, he was probably just manhandled by Doty from day one. And the bottom line is a lot of BS, in my view, has been circulated about the Roswell incident, about other supposed classified incidents involving UFOs, supposedly discussed at length in these MJ-12 papers. In my view, there's no credible evidence, persuasive evidence of any kind of comprehensive character that would substantiate the validity of the MJ-12 papers.
And now, aside from the meeting here with Venom, which obviously I agree with you, we don't want to touch that. So, but aside from that, did you ever have any run-ins with Doty or Bill Moore or people like that during that period? Because it sounds like, you know, you're kind of in that area, and they were kind of trying to keep an eye on all the different ufologists in the area. And obviously, like we talked about, you're tackling the best of the best as far as UFO cases go for quality. So I can see and touchy national security type stuff. So I can see how they'd want to keep an eye on you. So did they ever hassle you or try and feed you misinformation or anything?
Well, in March of '89, I circulated it in the UFO community, a summary of my investigation into the MJ-12 papers involving Doty and Moore and others. Within a month, Bill Moore actually showed up at my door, as it turns out. I wasn't aware at the time, and I was, long story short, I didn't even answer the door, but I didn't know he was there until after the fact. In any event, he subsequently made a telephone threat implying that he would sue me unless I retracted my statements about Bill Moore in this paper. The paper is called The MJ-12 Affair, Facts, Questions, and Comments, and it's available online. So very quickly, Bill Moore was trying to, let's say, he expressed his displeasure about what I had said publicly and was threatening, implying that he would take legal action against me if I didn't retract my statements. And yet, in July of '89, at the MUFON conference in Las Vegas, the national conference, Bill Moore substantiated most of what I had said in my paper. He admitted that he had been recruited by Doty. There was active dissemination of disinformation involving researcher Linda Howe, involving Paul Benowitz and others. So he basically confirmed what I knew from my investigation of the case. So he came after me. Doty also wrote me a nasty letter basically saying, none of this is true. I'm currently engaged in covert operations, but I do have a mailbox in Grants, New Mexico. Well, what I discovered was that he had already been taken out of OSI. He was involved in something that led him to be his status as a special agent to be withdrawn. He ended up working in a dining hall at Kirtland Air Force Base before he retired, had no intelligence responsibilities whatsoever. And furthermore, at the time he told me he was doing covert ops, he was actually a New Mexico State policeman busting speeders in Grants, New Mexico. That was his post-Air Force career. So I caught him in that little lie and threw it back at him and haven't heard from him since. For the last nearly 20 years in my lectures, I have been, when I'm asked about MJ-12, laying all of this out, talking about what I know about the deceptions involved, the persons involved. And, you know, I've said if Doty or Moore or any of these people have any problem with what I'm saying, they can indeed have their attorneys contact my attorney. I think the only way all of this information is only going to be established as to what occurred and what didn't occur is in a legal setting when everyone's under oath and risk of penalty of perjury and so on. You know, in the meantime, the rest of them are just going to keep telling these falsehoods and engaging in these tall tales and this disinformation. And unfortunately, some gullible segment of ufology is going to lap it up with a spoon. And sad, but there's really nothing can be done about it, in my view.
Yeah, yeah. And at the risk of beating a dead horse, what makes you so sure, or what evidence do you use, or you know, what makes you come to the conclusion that the MJ-12 documents are fraudulent? Just you know, what's your hit list here on that?
Typewriter analysis has shown that Doty was fabricating letters while at OSI. There was a typewriter at OSI at Kirtland that had a number of, this is back in the pre-computer, pre-keyboard age, the actual physical typewriter that was being used had a number of identifiable flaws in the type, the characters, the keys that struck the paper. And there were a number of items, again, off the top of my head, this is 20 years ago,
yeah,
that supposedly were typed by different individuals at different bases, and they all came back to this typewriter that Doty had used at Kirtland OSI. And the reason I was able to tie that in was because Doty typed a letter to a man named Craig Whitesell relating to a UFO sighting report in which he apparently used the same typewriter that had all the same identifiable key stroke defects. So we clearly tied it into Doty typing at OSI Kirtland, and then again extrapolating to these other documents, this identifying the same defects in these other fraudulent documents. So that's one of the reasons. What I point out in my paper is that, and this was again written in 1989, is that there was at that time, and to my mind there is to this day, not any credible evidence suggesting that an organization called MJ-12 ever existed. I know that according to Linda Howe's testimony to me, off-the-record comments at the time, that she was actually presented with some MJ-12 papers by Richard Doty and another then Air Force officer, Robert Collins, in Thanksgiving of, I think, 1988, on Thanksgiving Day, as I recall, without looking at my records. And so clearly these guys were disseminating papers that purportedly had to do with this group MJ-12. And at the same time, you have Doty fabricating various documents using this typewriter from Kirtland. So I think, you know, what are we to deduce here? That,
yeah,
some of what he was producing was fraudulent, but the other things he was presenting Linda Howe were absolutely real authenticated documents? No. I don't think so. And if you look at anyone who familiarizes themselves with the controversy about what supposedly was found at the National Archives involving MJ-12, the archivist, the leading archivist, I have letters from him saying that these were not properly coded. did. They did not have designations suggesting they were actually a part of these files at the National Archives, that they were just, in effect, planted there in the view of the archivist. So there's any number of elements to this that point, in my mind, to the fact that the MJ-12 papers are fraudulent.
Okay, all right. You kind of fill in a lot of the backstory here a little bit for me, because I've had Greg Bishop on the show, and we've talked about this whole mess at Kirtland Air Force Base back in the 80s, and so it's nice to hear from someone who also was on the trail of this back in the day. As we discussed, obviously, you've been in the UFO field here now for over 30 years, and sounds like you're a nuts-and-bolts sort of researcher, where you're interested in the solid witnesses, and you're not chasing after some of this crazy stuff. What's your opinion on how the UFO field has evolved over the 30 years that you've been in it? I've only been doing this for like 5 or 6 years, and I've been studying the history of it. I'm just amazed by the twists and turns that this quasi-science has taken. So what's your opinion of it? Because you've seen it from the front lines.
I have to tell you that the majority of the people that I speak with are former military people, and a handful of researchers such as Jim Klotz. I don't really acquainted myself with current developments in ufology, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. When I periodically see things online or things on the UFO program series run by the History Channel, it just seems to me to be essentially the same as it was 30 years ago. You have people who are going after nuts and bolts kinds of data, and there are other people who are just kind of willing to accept any story that comes down the pike with not a lot of substantiation. I think it's been qualitatively the same in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s to the present day. So I'm not sure that I would be knowledgeably answer in terms of what trends are taking place in ufology.
Okay. And if you could sort of lord over the field, what direction would you like to see it go? More towards this nuts and bolts thing, and there's a lot of this is sort of activism that's sort of reemerging. Obviously, the NICAP was a very activist organization in the 70s, and that kind of died out. But now in the 90s, with this disclosure movement and this exopolitics, there's sort of more of an activism that's coming along. That's also antagonistic at times with general ufology. So do you have a stance as far as, you know, the pure science-related study of UFOs versus the activist, proactive sort of UFO get-the-truth-out sort of attitude?
As I mentioned earlier in the interview, I think this whole process has a life of its own. I think in any controversial subject, you're going to have a diversity of opinions as to what's what and what's important, what's not important. There are people, for example, who I consider highly credible and engaging in the nuts and bolts cases involving nuclear weapons and other kinds of military-related cases, specifically Kevin Randall, I'm thinking of as one person, and yet he and I differ sharply as to the validity of the abduction reports. I think there is a core number of UFO abduction reports that have merit, that are important part of the overall puzzle, whereas Kevin believes it's all psychological or deception of one kind or another, and really there is no physicality to the reports. So, it's kind of a complicated situation. I don't think anyone I know would completely agree with what I say in terms of persons I respect in the field. They probably disagree with what I'm saying, but have applauded me for other things I'm saying. And the same would hold true for me. I don't agree 100% with anybody. So I think that's just part of the sorting out process, not only with UFOs, but any kind of situation where science and or the general public is trying to make sense of some unexplained phenomenon. As far as me lording over the field, that gets back to what I said earlier, too. My attitude has been I'm trying to take this subject on my terms. I'm not laying up at night worrying about it, going crazy about what direction it's taking and how I can influence or should be influencing the course of events. I just think that would be foolish and a waste of time. It's going to have its own direction. It's going to go left, right, backwards, forwards, and I think that's part of the process, and I just don't worry myself about it.
As we talked about earlier, you've been working on a book here, the UFO Nukes Connection. Any timetable on when we can see that on the horizon?
I'm hoping very early in 2008.
Okay, awesome, awesome. And that'll be obviously your articles are rich with stuff, and I presume that when the book comes out, it's just going to be just the bomb, with no pun intended.
Well, yeah, exactly. I'll let my research stand on its own. I think the credibility of the sources is excellent. I've tried to do them justice in terms of accurately reporting what they've had to say and substantiate as best as possible, whenever possible, what they're saying in terms of declassified documents. So hopefully most people will find it to be worthy of their attention.
Awesome. Yeah, when the book comes out, definitely we'll have you back on the show to delve even deeper into this subject.
Very good. Thank you.
Obviously, like you said, the book, hopefully sometime early next year. What's next on the horizon for you? I know you're a very busy lecturer, so I presume you've got some events coming down the pike. So, what's coming up for you throughout the rest of 2007 and onward?
The only two confirmed lecture dates that I have in the fall at this point, I can give them to you. I'm going to be at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut on October 9th. And on the 25th of October, I'm going to be in Manchester, New Hampshire, at St. Anselm's College. And persons interested in attending those programs can contact the school probably in the fall. I don't think you'll find anyone now who will have the details as far as the facilities and so on. But in early October, you should be able to find out where the programs will be held. I also have several other lectures that I believe will come through in the fall, but they're not confirmed dates at this point.
Okay, awesome, awesome. Well, feel free to shoot me an email when you get them, and we'll post the information on the page with the interview.
I'll do that, thank you.
All right, well, Robert, thank you very much for coming on the show. Obviously, you've done some great work, and you're doing great research into key UFO cases, the important ones, and finding awesome witnesses for them. And really, these are the kind of cases that we need to hammer home to people that the UFO phenomenon is a real thing and something that needs to be taken seriously. So hats off to you for your work, and thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
There you have it, folks. That does it for this week's edition of Banal of America Audio. Big, big thanks to Robert Hastings for coming on the show. As we noted at the beginning, Robert does not have a website, but if you go to the page where you found this interview, there's links to three great articles written by Robert, so you can find out more information on his research. Moving right along now, it's time for Banal of America Audio listener feedback, and this week's letter comes from Rick H., no hometown listed. Here's what Rick has to say. Tim, first I must say that you have the best show out there on internet land when it comes to the whole ufology thing. I listen to your show as often as I can. Anyway, what I am emailing you about is a suggestion for a guest on your show. His name is Gian Cassar. He is an acclaimed explorer and author and has been studying the Bermuda Triangle for over 20-some years or more. The Bermuda Triangle has sparked my interest for years. The mystery of all these lost ships and planes gone forever, along with the forgotten families and friends, is possibly the greatest phenomena mankind has ever faced on this planet. Gian covers the complete history of the Triangle, missing aircraft and ships, theories behind the Triangle, myths and facts, etc. His book, Into the Bermuda Triangle, covers all this and so much more. So I hope you check out all this info. I believe it would be a number one show on your site, up there with the Skinwalker Ranch show you did some time ago. Thank you, Rick H., no hometown listed. No, Rick, thank you for the fine correspondence, the props, I appreciate them so much, and the guest suggestion. I actually emailed Rick back earlier after I first received the email, but I'll spill the beans to you folks, too. We only have two episodes left of Banal of America Audio Season 2, so at this point, we're not really looking to book any new guests until the fall season rolls around and we start planning for Season 3. But I will add Gian Cassar's name to the list. He's someone who I have considered having on Banal of America Audio for quite some time. Just haven't done the legwork, really, to get it all lined up. But for Season 3, I will put him high on the list. Which brings me to an additional point, folks. If you have guest suggestions, now's the best time to send them in, because over the summer we'll begin planning Season 3, we'll begin setting it all up, making the necessary contacts, taping the first few interviews for Season 3. So if you have someone you want to hear on Banal of America Audio, send it in to us, and we'll see what we can do about getting them on the show. Thank you again, Rick, for your kind words and the guest suggestion. Even if you don't have a guest suggestion, maybe you have a question, maybe you have a comment, maybe you just want to be a part of Banal of America Audio listener feedback, there's a couple ways to do it. You either go to banalofamerica.com, click the contact button at the bottom of the left-hand side menu. You'll see it. It says contact. Click it. That'll bring you to the page with the contact information. Or simply write to boaaudio@hotmail.com, boaaudio@hotmail.com. Either one of those methods puts your correspondence on the road to BOA Audio listener feedback. Up next, we do it to it with the thanks to the fantastic banalofamerica.com staff, Leslie Chiron, R. Lee, Joe V., and Tina Senna. They write fantastic columns at banalofamerica.com. We've got tons of great stuff in the pipeline coming to you, as we say, every week. Don't just listen to the audio show, check out the columns, otherwise you're only getting half the story. And feel free to make banalofamerica.com a part of your everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. Now comes the time in the show when I ask you for donations. I can't stress it enough, folks. We need donations. We need donations to pay for the phone calls. We need donations to pay for the bandwidth. We need donations to pay for just a host of stuff that you wouldn't even believe. We need the donations from longtime listeners or appreciative newcomers. You've stumbled upon Banal America Audio. You love it, and you want to know how you can help keep the show going and growing. And there's a way to do that. You go to banalofamerica.com, you click the PayPal button, and you make a donation. No donation is too small, and they all go towards paying for banalofamerica.com and BOA Audio. Make a donation if you can. It would be hugely appreciated. Next week on the program, to be announced. I'm taping the episode on Tuesday. I actually had to reschedule the episode because, as you may have noticed by now, I'm losing my voice, and we were going to tape it when this affliction first started, when it was much worse than it is now. So we rescheduled the interview to this coming Tuesday. I'll be taping next week's episode on Tuesday, and on Wednesday we'll have a little announcement at banalofamerica.com regarding who the guest is. But I will tell you that it is a cryptozoology-themed episode, and we're going to be talking about the mysterious and nefarious Bigfoot from a very different perspective than you get from mainstream cryptozoology. So it's going to be a little fringe cryptozoology next week with the guest to be announced on Wednesday. And then, of course, next week's episode is the penultimate episode of Season 2, which means in 2 weeks we've got the big, huge, blockbuster Banal of America Audio Season 2 season finale. This year's season finale guest is just amazing. This guy goes beyond a legend. He's a true icon, a first ballot Hall of Famer in the world of esoterica. Name and musical preview to be announced very, very soon. That, of course, is going to air at banalofamerica.com June 30th, 2007. We're going to close out BOA Audio Season 2 with a huge bang, folks. You're going to love this episode. I've already listened to it a couple times, and it is amazing. There you have it. All that and more coming to banalofamerica.com very, very soon. Stay tuned, folks. And on that note, I'm going to close it out and try and get a little rest for my weary voice. Until you hear from me next week, thank you so much for listening. This is Tim Banal, signing off.